welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. My name is Rob. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2013, and you are listening right now, right here, right now, to episode 47. As usual, hanging out in the studio with me is Mr. Jason Slingerland. How's it going, sir?
It's going well, sir.
Fantastic. We have, as we do on occasion, an extra special, wonderful bonus guest with us today on this episode. On the line, we have Mr. Brian LaBurge. Hi, Brian.
Hey, guys.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you.
And Brian is somebody we met via the podcast. I actually met Brian beforehand one time at Gen Con.
That's right.
We got to be in a Dread game together. The Dread game I've probably talked about like 100 times on this show.
I think you have, yeah.
So Brian is one of the people from that. So
it was a good game.
It was fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, some kind of demented evil circus thing.
Yes. He was the dog
was
boy, and you were fantastic as the dog boy.
Well, thank you. Absolutely
fantastic. So yeah, we have Brian.
Yeah, we know Brian. That's how I heard about your show, because you were like, "Yeah, I do this thing called Building the Game." It's like I have no idea what that is, but I wrote it down.
That's awesome, because you know sometimes it feels like you do that in vain, like right, like you're passing out cards, you're telling people about your stuff, and then like. You're like, they're not going to remember. So the fact that you actually started listening after that, that's awesome.
That's great.
Thank you. I didn't know that.
Yeah, sweet. Or maybe you gave me a business card. But either way, like I went through it and I said, okay, well, let me check out an episode of this. And then I think I went back and I listened to the rest of them. I love the show. It's great what you guys do.
Thank you. That means a lot to us. And you are no slouch yourself, Brian. You were giving us, before we start recording here, a quick rundown of some of your many, many accomplishments. Which we don't really have time to talk about all of them on the show today, but let's see. We'll start with some of the simple stuff. You work or you write for several publications, right?
Yeah. So I am a freelancer. If somebody has heard of me, it's probably because of that. I've written a lot of D&D 4th edition material for Kobold Press, both in their magazine and some of their supplements. Like we did the Kobold Bestiary for Midgard, the 4th edition version. And a lot of products associated with that. I was the lead developer on The Defenders of Midgard, which is a player source book.
Okay.
And I did the 4E translation of Dark Roads and Golden Hells, which was originally a Pathfinder book. That's actually, the 4E version is not out yet. It'll come out sometime this year.
Cool.
Yeah. And I've written for Raging Swan Press, which is a great name of a company that does Pathfinder PDFs that these guys put out, I don't know, 1 to 2 PDFs a week, easy. I do one a month for them.
Wow, and that's pretty prolific.
It's
kind
crazy.
Of production. Wow.
Most of them are like 7 pages long. So you're just buying for like $2, somewhere around there usually, depending on the length, you know, just a little snippet of what you need. They do a lot of books that are primarily charts and descriptions. So the line I do for them is called Urban Dressing, and so for example, the very first Urban Dressing was market stalls, and there's 100 descriptions of market stalls that have nothing to do with what they sell. It's just like, this market stall has iron poles and green silks hanging as a roof. You can roll on that table and get like a quick description if you're in the marketplace. There's another one table in there that has a bunch of different NPCs. There's a table in there that has actual like mundane market goods, so you can just, if you're not used to coming up with things on the fly, you can quickly generate things in your session. Or if you want to use it to help you prepare, you know, you can roll on the table and get some ideas, or just read through and get some ideas. And we've done a bunch of those. Temples just came out. Temples is probably my favorite one so far.
That is so cool.
Yeah,
Jason and I just looked at each other and we just had this big grin on our faces. Like,
super awesome.
Oh, man. Oh, that's
I love charts.
That, you know, me
charts
too.
Are cool.
Yeah, especially when it comes to an RPG. I love a bunch of pages of charts, and I can roll a die. It'll tell me a thing. I'll be like, there, it's in the game. Let's go.
That's right. Let's do it.
I love that.
Yeah. These are Pathfinder specific, but because so much of it is description, I mean, you can run it for any swords and sorcery type game, really. And we try to keep it low magic, which I think helps sort of push it into multiple settings.
That is cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's fun.
And you do a few podcasts, you mentioned?
Well, I do RPG Circus every other week, which is an RPG podcast where we talk about news, you know, different products that are going up, and people saying stupid things on the internet and you know what accounts for news in the RPG world. And then we always do three topics. It's a three-ring circus. So each host brings a new topic, and we sort of bicker about RPG accessories or whether orcs have been done too much and things like that. It's a good time.
Cool.
It's very casual.
Yeah. We like casual.
We do like casual.
Yeah. That's great. Perhaps on a more serious note here, because this is kind of in the hearts and minds of everybody in the country right now. You are a resident of Boston, right?
I am. Yep. Yeah. I am a Bostonian, sir.
Right. And just this past week we had a horrible tragedy, the bombing there, and you were very nearby the area when it happened, weren't you?
It's true. My wife and I and some of my friends were at the Red Sox game that day, and on Marathon Monday, Patriots Day in Massachusetts, the holiday, the Red Sox game starts at 11 o'clock in the morning, 11:05, as opposed to like every other game ever.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is during the seventh inning stretch, theoretically, the marathon runners would run by. That's the reason why they do it.
Oh, okay.
But as it just so happens, because of that, the game got out, and we were looking for something to eat. We didn't want to do it too close to the park because it was mobbed. We walked down towards the finish line, mainly because there's a big mall there called the Prudential Center. Mm-hmm. And we were on one side of the mall, but the side opposite the finish line. I mean, the mall, the Prudential Center, is like right in front of the finish line. And we were on the other side, so essentially like a block or two away. When, you know, we saw people running through the mall, like trying to get out in a hurry. And there was a lot of different stories going around. Some people thought there had been gunshots, explosions, a collapse, but everyone knew that they were supposed to evacuate. So, you know, we went and we kept going. We're local, so we know Boston pretty well. So we were able to sort of like make a path for ourselves and just get out of the area. Mm-hmm. And as we went along, we saw runners and we got a little bit more information about what happened. And it was just, awful.
That must have been terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we knew the right thing to do was just like keep moving.
Yeah.
And so people, you know, they kept it together, but it was the lack of information that's always so unsettling.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Especially once the cell phones went down, they took the cell phones down.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, intentionally, so that if there was any more packages, they couldn't be remotely detonated.
Sure. Yep. Okay.
I would never thought of that, but that
right,
totally
makes sense.
But it was causing confusion because people couldn't use their cell phones to contact people, and obviously people had been separated. So
yeah. Wow. Well, I can't imagine such a thing to experience firsthand like that. That's that's crazy. And we're glad that you and your family and all your friends are okay.
Yeah, everyone that I know is okay.
Okay,
I had a friend that was very close to the finish line, but he's fine too.
Good.
And, of course, Beerstar Games is my company, and it's a local company. It primarily was founded to produce Pulp, which is the big RPG I'm doing right now. Pulp premiered at the Boston Festival of Indie Games. You know, Beerstar Games is a local company. All my playtesters are local for the most part. So I really wanted to do something after this happened, and I decided the best thing to do was to do something with my game. So as of last Tuesday, actually, what we're doing is anybody who buys Pulp, if you buy the physical book, if you buy the PDF, doesn't matter, any profits that I make from that we're giving to the Red Cross. And since it's now Monday, I was originally going to go do it through Tuesday, but I'm going to extend it to this coming Friday so that the listeners of Building the Game have a chance that if you want to pick up Pulp and you want to make sure it goes to a good cause, you can do that.
That's excellent. What a generous thing to do.
That is just awesome, man.
So, yeah, so through this coming Friday the 26th, right?
Yep.
All right. Where can our listeners find that?
Well, you can go to pulptherpg.com.
Pulp?
And that'll have links for all sorts of various Pulp versions.
All right. Pulptherpg.com.
You got it.
All right. Everybody check that out. Wow.
Yeah.
So with all that going on, have you been playing many games lately?
Oh, sure. You know, I'm a tabletop designer by nature. You know, I've got a group that's local. We play a lot of tabletop games. Uh-huh. But luckily, I can talk to you guys about some things because PAX East just happened just a few weeks ago.
Oh, of course it did.
Yep, which is our big local convention. It's like, you know, something like 85,000 people. They stopped releasing the numbers, so that's just something like that. And
it's a guess.
It's like two Gen Cons, you know, stacked on top of each other in an aircraft hangar.
Right.
And so that I got to play more not tabletop RPGs than usual. So I've been playing a lot of little stuff, but probably the thing that I've been playing the most of all is a little game called Ascension.
Oh,
you guys know this game? Have you ever heard of Ascension?
I think I've heard of that.
Heard of Ascension, yeah. Yes.
primarily through my phone, but I believe it is pretty much the same game. That is my understanding.
That's what I've been told. I only play it through my phone, but I've been told that it's basically the same game in tabletop form.
Yeah.
So I've been playing that with, you know, other friends of mine who aren't local. You know, we just take a turn, send it over. They take a turn. It's been a lot of fun.
Right on.
I know you guys talked about Ascension a little bit before in the show.
Yeah, I still haven't had a chance to try it, but I've heard nothing but glowing reviews.
You should play some Ascension, man.
I need to. I have an Android phone, so that's...
Oh, that's different.
It is.
I can't play Ascension with you on your Android phone.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
I normally just play against the computer, because when I play games against other people, I just get frustrated because it takes forever.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I'm one of those, like, let's do it right now, person, so... I got frustrated
playing Ascension against the AI because I found that it was really repetitive.
It is.
And
I
haven't bought the expansions yet. I don't know if that makes it better for the AI.
I got one of them, but I haven't.
Are you sleepy? What the heck?
I'm yawning over here.
Yeah.
I did get one of them. So, and it seemed all right. Yeah. It was quite a while back. It was probably 6 or 7 months ago.
Okay.
There's another digital card game that I like that I bet you guys haven't played, which might be a little bit more interesting to talk about.
Okay.
It's a little embarrassing, but for you guys, I'm going to admit that I play it. there used to be a cartoon show on a couple of years ago. You can still see it in syndication sometimes if you're a six-year-old and like these kind of cartoons, called the Superhero Squad. Which is like a chibi version of the Marvel superheroes.
Yep.
Oh.
I've heard of that.
All on the same team. I have a 4-year-old daughter. She loves it. and there's an online version of this game. It is like a browser-based multiplayer online RPG.
Huh.
And built into it is a card game that I think is also a physically published card game, but I don't know anyone who plays it, so I've been playing it on the computer.
Can you get that for like the iPhone?
I don't think so, because you've got to sign in to like their server on a browser. I don't think there's a mobile version.
Okay.
I would love it if they did a mobile version of just like the side games, because all I really want to do is play the card game.
Right. Nice.
Okay.
I don't want to run around and pretend to be Chibi Spider-Man. That's a little weird. But I do want to play this card game, which is very simple. They've broken down all the heroes and villains into certain types. So it's like animal type and strength type and tech type.
Huh.
And each card will have a hero on it, and it'll have its own little name, and it'll have a type, and then it'll have a block. And it's not like strength is always strong against tech. It's just each individual card is different depending on what the description, the flavor text of the card is. So I might throw down a daredevil card, and it'll be the animal type that blocks tech for whatever reason. And so it's sort of like a resource management game. Okay. Where I want to throw down cards that I think he can't block so I can do damage. But sometimes I'm concerned more about what blocks I have in my hand. So it's like, oh, I really want to throw this animal card down because I'm pretty sure I can't block animal. But this is my only strength block, and he's going to hit me with a Hulk card, and it's going to hurt.
That sounds cool. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, you can actually play it for free online if you go to HeroUp.com. But
HeroUp.com, I'll have to check it out.
It's so embarrassing because it's just like all these like,
yeah,
weird little kid versions of superheroes.
That's pretty funny.
It is. It's fun. It's fun, though. It's a fun little card game, and I think there's a real version of the card game.
Well, maybe we should go ahead and move on to our mechanic of the week, if that's okay with you, gentlemen.
Oh yeah,
sounds good.
All right, and Brian, I think you have something ready for us to discuss here.
Yeah, for the mechanic of the week.
Ooh,
right.
Somebody's listened to the show before.
That's true. So the mechanic of the week that I brought for you guys, because I know you love the different stuff, and I love role-playing games. Even when I'm playing other games, I love role-playing games. And so accidental role playing is what I'm bringing to the table. And I'll give you a couple of examples. There are some great games out there that do not encourage role playing, like in the rules. Like it's your job is not to pretend to be the general or the soldier.
Yeah.
But sometimes this can sort of come out anyway at the table, where people sort of get into it and start playing. I think a great example of that is Pandemic, where you've got sort of this built-in scenario that's clearly sort of a scene, if you will, even if it's a big scene, and you've got characters. But it's still not a role-playing game. But people will sort of play it out anyway. Or even with Munchkin, where you've got like these fantasy tropes or your Cthulhu tropes, depending on which version of Munchkin you play. I've been playing Cthulhu Munchkin. You sort of like, you're throw that curse on your friend and you might end up cackling evilly, even though it has nothing to do with the game.
And doing the hand motion and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I find that these things help sell a game. I really do, because it's sort of instant, an enjoyment bump. If you can really get into it, even though that's not part of the game mechanics, it automatically makes the game more appealing. So if you can create a game that's got like a heavy enough theme or sort of like this idea of a role, the role playing will happen anyway for the people who like that stuff.
Yeah. Right. I'm terribly guilty of that.
Rob does this a lot.
I do that all the time. I
can't
love it.
Help it.
It's fun. It's fun.
And it's not something to be ashamed of, you know?
Well, and I see nothing wrong with it. I just don't do it as much. But I think back to the first time we play tested one of my prototypes, which was Gunslinging Ramblers, which is a game about cowboys. Rob immediately wanted to talk like a cowboy.
The whole time.
The whole game.
He couldn't
help
it.
He was the only one.
I couldn't help it. I had to.
And you really were the only one, but you very much wanted to.
And I do the same thing whenever I play a pirate-themed game. I want to talk like a pirate.
No, it does not surprise me at all.
This. Yeah. When you talk like a cowboy, are you just talking like John Wayne?
You know, I do a very terrible John Wayne, so no. I think it's more inspired by old Clint Eastwood westerns and you know, like Slim Pickens kind of stuff.
Oh, sure.
Nation, you know, and that kind of thing. That's the cowboy that I respond to.
All right.
Yeah, no, that's great. But man, how can you plan for that if you're designing a game? I mean, is that something that you can not necessarily put into the game as a requirement, but can you help structure your game to encourage it?
I do. I think you can. I think the way you do it, and I don't know that people actually do this intentionally, but I do think it's possible. I think the way you do it is to make sure that two of your mechanics are phrased in two very specific ways. That there's a scene element to your theme, where your theme isn't just like, I don't know, chickens, right? Because that's boring. It's the farm.
Okay.
And two, if there's some kind of role, even if you're not specifically doing like role distribution, if you're casting spells, then you have a role. You know, but sometimes there are games that have role distribution where like I'm playing the meta character. Well, then automatically that helps.
Yeah.
So in Gunslinging Ramblers, those two things were instantly present. Like, you are a gunslinger.
Yep,
that's true.
And you are in the Old West.
Yeah, that's true.
So bam. As long as you've got those two things, I think it helps a great deal. Like, when you're playing Risk, it's less likely to come up. I've seen it happen. I've still seen accidentally role-playing happen in Risk.
In Risk? Like, not Risk Legacy, like, straight up
but
Risk?
Like, straight up Risk. I've seen it happen. I play with a lot of theater kids, but... Wow. But it doesn't happen as often because it's not like you're playing it's not like anywhere it says like you're the general of this army and it's 1492, you know, which wasn't a great year for war. So I don't know why I said 1492, 1812.
1812, there you go.
but if they did, I think it would switch. I think it would swap on you. You know, there was just a little bit more theme to the mechanics. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't just rolling dice for cannons, but rolling dice for, you know, the battle of this, you know.
And maybe give some actual characters in there, some names, some titles, some more familiarity with the apparent people involved with those battles, you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think you could do this with a lot of games. I think if you took Monopoly, and you replaced and you took out like just took out the random pieces, and each piece actually represented somehow your real estate magnet.
Yeah.
You know, your Mr. Moneybags. If they were all like different versions of Mr. Moneybags, it's like bam, it would happen.
Huh. That's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in Ramblers has that because I mean, you yourself are not. Well, there are a bunch of character cards with names and things in the game, and mm-hmm. you yourself are some kind of outside person, not to expose too much of the game. So stop me if I'm going too far, Jason.
I will stop you if you go too far.
But you are some kind of you're like an outside party who is hiring these characters to do your bidding. But
sure.
Still, but you want to see yourself in that setting, in that world, at that table, you know.
And I think for a game like that, it's easy if you're that type of person to slip into that. I mean,
yeah.
The different characters, you know, they're all very different, and they all have very very different, you know, themes they kind of go with within the game. And mm-hmm. I think that in addition to that, I lost my train of thought.
Okay,
let me reset that.
Sure.
I think if you look at the different characters in the game, not only do they thematically and their names and such really kind of call that out, the mm-hmm. artwork, when people see that, will yeah. really do that too. The artwork really pushes that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do the same thing. When we play Redneck Life, Brian, I don't know if you've ever played that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, but I know of it.
Yeah. Okay. Like the first thing you do in that game is you roll some dice to come up with your redneck name. And then you get married and roll some more dice to get your husband or wife's redneck name, you mm-hmm. know. And so it's just fun. And you get youngins as you play through the game. They all have names. And by you literally are kind of building a family on your little score sheet as you play the game. And it kind of helps. It makes me want to talk like those people.
Yeah, it's like the game of life.
Yeah.
Which I haven't played in a really long time. But like those people didn't have names, but you put the little people in your car. And, you know, they ended up with personalities anyway, because it's like, oh, I guess my kid's going to college. Must be a smarty pants.
Right. Yeah.
But you still didn't end up role-playing in life. Well, maybe a little bit, but because there was still that sort of, like, distance. Because there wasn't quite a strong enough theme and a strong enough sense of characters. I think probably because there was no faces and there was no names, maybe. I don't
know. Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, a contrary experience that I had to that, though, was playing Mansions of Madness, which...
Oh, I remember you talking about this fun experience you had.
Yeah, and I mean that game. That's, you know, it's a role playing game essentially, kind of simplified down to a board game. I kind of didn't really have any interest in role playing or playing as that character. And I mean, we had to pick specific characters with names and faces and skills and backgrounds, and you know they had some kind of a little flavor text piece on every single one of the characters to kind of help tell you who that person was. And maybe that was just me not responding to those specific characters. Maybe that's why I didn't engage with that. But
if memory serves me correct, and you correct me because you actually had the experience, I'm just trying to remember what you said about it. It sounded like in that game in particular, the mechanics sort of started getting confusing and bogged things down a little bit.
Yeah.
And also, if I remember correctly, you said the mechanics kind of pulled you out of the game because
they
often didn't match the game.
Yeah.
Complicated mechanics is the first thing that kills a tabletop RPG as far as the role-playing experience goes. Yeah. It's one of the things that people really complained about when D&D jumped from the 3.5 edition, 3.x, into 4th edition. Is the mechanics really changed, and they felt like the mechanics described so much and there was so much to look at, to read, that it just pulled the role play out of it and it became a combat game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same thing's going to kill a board game, you know, is it kill that chance to have accidental role play. If, like, you're always trying to figure things out, or you're just, if things are just dragging, like, you need that fun sort of momentum to get into role-playing. You need to not be able to think about the mechanics so you can have fun doing everything else. That's probably, we didn't talk about that earlier, but that really is a component of it. You almost need something that moves a little faster.
You're right.
Yep.
Yeah, if you put too much, if the player has to think too much about what he's doing and how he's going to plan himself, he's not going to be thinking about what his character might be doing or saying at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a really good point.
It is.
So we need simple mechanics, or at least mechanics that are fluid and they influence the gameplay in a way that draws you more in rather than takes you out.
Yeah.
Even if the mechanics aren't like super simple, but you can manage to memorize them after playing for a little while,
people
will make that jump.
Yeah.
It is, though. I mean, I've definitely noticed in fourth edition when we've played, it's like we're role playing, and now we're fighting.
Yep.
And there's no crossover between the two.
Right.
There's all sorts of conversation about how to get people to stay in character in 4E fights. And so the fact that there's so much conversation is very indicative of the real problem there.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Man.
As somebody who designs for 4E, and I still do a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Even though the game is essentially unsupported by the publisher.
Yeah.
Not that I'm angry or anything, Wizards of the Coast. I was getting paid to do these things.
this is not the first time they've done this to their people.
No.
Yeah. I experience that at my regular game table. It's like we get into combat and there's far less RP going on. Just the other day I was playing D&D and my a friend of mine, Dan, he was using a power called Vicious Mockery. And I said, okay, great. And he picked up his die and I said, no, wait. What do you say?
Yeah.
And shocked, like I took him right out of it. I'm attacking. And I was like, it's called Vicious Mockery. I want to know what you say.
That's a good point. Great. Yeah, you know, I remember having that problem with just people doing simple bluff checks, you know? And rather than trying to give me the whole thing, they would say, I'm going to try and bluff this guy to give me what I want.
Well, that's why you and I had so much fun when you ran the game, because I had a good bluff, and I will talk through the bluffs. Even if it's not great, I will talk through the bluffs.
Yeah, and my attitude as the DM was, you know, well, if you give me a good speech, I might give you a bonus to your roll.
Right.
But, absolutely.
Yeah.
I do the same thing at my table.
Absolutely, to try and encourage that. But, you know, if you get somebody who's not as into that, they just say, look, I'm comfortable with the bonus I've already got with my roll. Let me just roll. And that's a bummer.
I don't know if you guys have been following the development on D&D Next, but at least at one point, because I haven't read the most recent version, that was written right into the rules, where they said, if somebody gives an outstanding speech and it, you know, from their words alone, they just crit the diplomacy check, like they don't roll. It's, you know, it's up to the DM, but it's just like, great. They just crit the diplomacy check because you're standing up and clapping right now.
Yeah.
You know? Well, not to just get on like a bandwagon of bashing 4E, but like one of the biggest things they took out, you know, like was so many of the soft sides of the game, you know what I mean? Like the non-crunch stuff just went away in, you know, so that they could have the game basically feel like it was playing D&D miniatures, which is what I felt like most of the time when I was playing the game. Not that we didn't have fun, because I really like D&D miniatures. Mm-hmm. So
I feel like that happened in 3.5, and essentially 3.0, but the way they were phrasing things in 4E made it more evident.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and they dropped things in 4E, like crafting and all that kind of stuff, things that you really saw in 3.5 that we really liked.
Well, here's the deal, though. They didn't drop crafting in 4th edition. They dropped the mechanics. There's less crunch in that area now.
Right, but that was an area where crunch was actually nice to have, right? Because, I mean, it made you feel like, you know, because there are some DMs you play with that they have to have a rule for stuff, right? If there's not a rule, they just assume you can't do it. So
that sounds like you got a problem with your DM, buddy. I'm sorry.
No, I'm not saying, and this is not Rob. I'm talking about a different DM in the past, but... You know, they're like, hey, you know, you can't do that anymore. And I'm the type of person that if I'm running a game, I'm going to say, screw it. I'm just going to make my own rules for that because I want you to be able to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I mean, and I'm not saying you're wrong, because that's the way people felt. And it was made very clear when 4th edition first came out that people felt that way. But if you listen to the designer's response, their response was like, if you want to be a blacksmith, write blacksmith on your character sheet. Like, you don't need to spend points in that, you know? Like, you can totally do it.
Yeah.
Like, that is our intention. That was their intention in dropping the craft rules, is they didn't want you to have to sacrifice other areas to be good at blacksmithing.
That's a fair point. I can see that. I think there are other ways to do it to make it feel like there's a reason for both, but you know what I mean?
They made it seem unimportant to a lot of people by pulling the mechanics. It was like they weren't supporting the idea of being a blacksmith anymore.
Right. They should have had a section that was like, for this type of stuff, if you want to do it, right? You know, like, hey, there's no specific rules, but we still encourage you to do that. That would have been nice.
Yeah, it would have been great.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Presentation is so a huge part of how people are going to take your games and run with it.
Yeah. We got to bring this back in, though. We're way off topic. So anyway, accidental role playing. We love it. All three of us love it. Yep. Hey, listeners, you should love it too. Okay, that is what we declare.
That was a good summary there. Yeah.
Well, let's move on. It's time for practicing the pitch now, sir. And as the guest, in addition to bringing a mechanic to discuss, it is also your duty, your responsibility to pitch a new game idea to us.
Oh, and it's a big duty.
Dance, monkey, dance.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. What you got for us today, sir, Mr. Brian, Mr. Special Guest?
I have got a game that is definitely still in development, very early, early stages, so I'm hoping you guys can help me out.
Okay.
It's a game that I'm calling Ante, and it is a tabletop RPG that uses a standard deck for 52-card playing card deck as its base mechanic. So I think there's going to be some fun card game mechanics underneath it. And just like when we were talking about with accidental role-playing, it's probably something that would be able to stand on its own without the role-playing if we get the mechanics good enough.
This already sounds like madness to me.
I'm mad. I'm a crazy person. So absolutely. So the core of the game is it's all about building and betting your own reputation. The theme is sort of loose post-apocalyptic. Everybody is living in small communities, and the community that we're focused on is this little tiny space station where everything is automated to an extent. You know, everybody still has a job that helps maintain this space station, but everything is integrated. There's cameras everywhere and commuter terminals everywhere. And your own status is heavily monitored by this program or this person called the dealer, who manages everything. And everybody has four statuses that are constantly in flux that they're always trying to increase. And that's the game where you're sort of trying to get all four of your statuses up, which can be very difficult because they're also your resources. And the four main statuses are represented by the four different suites in a deck of cards. So you've got your body, which is your health, your physical abilities, and that's spades. You've got your reputation, which is clubs, what people think of you, what you think of yourself. You've got spirit, which is hearts, which is sort of your emotional and mental well-being. And you've got wealth, which is diamonds, which is the most common, the easiest thing to use. You know, we all are familiar with using wealth as currency. That's easy.
Sure.
The way the mechanics of the game plays out is everybody starts with three cards, randomly dealt.
So you're going to deal me. You're going to deal each of us three cards, and I'm going to
deal everybody three cards
of random suits. We have no idea what we're getting.
Yep.
Standard 52 card deck.
Standard 52 card deck.
Okay.
And you are going to take a look at your cards, and you're going to decide which of those cards you want to represent your starting score. So obviously you're not going to have four scores starting out. You only have three cards. They may all be the same suit, you know. So you might just put like one clubs down, and your other scores haven't been assigned yet. And until those are assigned, they're sort of treated as middle of the run and not important to the game. And then, as play moves around the table, it's got a very simple mechanic where you're always pulling a card, but you're not necessarily always playing a card.
Okay.
So you can play a card and replace one of your skills if you've got something better, or on your turn, you can try to fight for something better. And when you fight for something better, right now the way I've been doing it is with a very simple sort of war mechanic where you're either fighting the dealer and playing against the deck, or you're fighting against another person. And basically you say, I am going to try to raise my reputation on this particular hand. And you can pull a random card off the top of the deck if you want to, and if you pull a random card off the top of your deck, you're not really risking much.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can play one of the cards you already have and hope that whatever gets played from the dealer, the next random card down, isn't going to beat you. You're trying to get the high card. And if you win, then you get to both replace your score and pull that extra card down, so you've got one more resource.
So by replace your score, you mean
Yeah, so you've already, so you want, at the end of the game, you want to have four high cards in front of you, one of each. That's the goal. Like, if you could get, you know, something above, 10 or above in each suit, like, that would be awesome. Like, then you're living the good life.
So, I just want to make sure I understand this. So, I have an 8 of clubs down, right?
Yep.
And I say, I want to increase my reputation.
Yeah. Which is hard, because 8's not that small.
Yeah, it's pretty high.
Oh, I'm just throwing numbers out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and you say I'm going to play my 8, and then you flip the top card off the deck.
Yep.
And that top card is a 6.
Yep.
So you beat the 6.
Okay, so if you want to replace the 8, so because you want to replace the 8, you're trying to get something higher.
Okay, so that's why I was confused.
So
okay.
What you're gonna do is, if you already had a higher card in your hand, you can just put that down, and the 8 gets discarded. And it's gone. But if you want to work towards that, you can take your action to play against the dealer, in which case you're gonna pull a card off the top of the deck, flip it over, hope it's bigger than the next card that gets played down. So when you're playing against a dealer, it's really random.
Okay.
And it's dangerous in the sense that it's really random, but you're not risking much. All you're risking is that random card you're pulling off the top of the deck. If you're playing against another player, it gets more dangerous.
Well, so it sounds like I'm going to have some cards in my hand here, and I might be holding on to a high value card.
Yep.
Just to kind of keep that in reserve, just in case if I'm going to need it in a particularly difficult conflict, or if I hit a difficult spot and I'm going to need to put that down on the table in front of me to boost one of my stats.
Yep.
And so
there's a bartering system sort of built in, and I think that's where the interesting stuff with the other players come in, because anything you have in your card is a resource. You could try to trade for other people. You know, you may have an 8 of clubs down and have another 6 of clubs in your hand. Obviously, that 6 isn't good to you. You already have something better.
Yeah.
But somebody to your left might have a 2 of clubs down, but stuck with it. And maybe they've got something else that you need. So you can trade.
So you could say, I'll give you my 6 of clubs for your 2 of clubs, knowing that in your hand you have a 7 of clubs that you could lay down afterwards. Then you get something else from them out of that deal, like maybe a higher diamond you could use.
Yep.
And then you put that out, and then you know that you're now replacing your club with something better, and you've improved your diamond score.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can do that willingly where you're trading, but there is sort of the mystery of what you have in your hands. You can also challenge people. And when you challenge people, it's the same thing. It's just like when you're playing war against the dealer. You can pull something off the top of the deck, and it's random, and then you're really risking things. Or you can play from your hand. It doesn't make sense to play from your hand when you're challenging the dealer, because when you're doing that, you're only going for what's in front of you.
Right. Right.
When you're playing against another person, like, you might be holding things in reserve that are good enough to beat people, not good enough to replace what you have.
Okay.
And the idea of it is, it's not really meant to be a standalone card game. All of these individual actions would be scenes.
Okay.
So if you have really low spirit, you know, you're gonna be jealous of people who have higher spirit. You know, you're gonna want to get to a place in the space station where you can to raise that up somehow. Spirit is your sort of your emotional and mental well-being. So maybe you're going to try to do something to make you self feel better. Maybe you're going to seek counseling. It's a sci-fi game, so it may even be some sort of augmentation. You know, you're going to seek out a scene where you can raise that, and the mechanic is only going to be a small part of playing that out.
Okay,
that makes sense.
So when we're playing the game and we're in this now. Is this like the game master is putting us through I'm trying to think of this. Is this structured like D&D or Cthulhu? You know, Call of Cthulhu, where you're following the story, or is it more like something like Fiasco, where you're just kind of generating this bizarre tale as you go along, kind of organically?
Yeah, it's more like Fiasco, and okay. I didn't touch on that enough. So one of the things that I didn't mention before that sort of helps ties it into Fiasco is that each of these cards isn't just like a really vague representation. I want to have lists built into sort of the rules. So you're playing a card
like play game, sets.
Yeah. Yeah. Like play sets. Like, and so this space station is just sort of the base play set. But in reality, any time you've got a situation where you're sort of vying to make it clear that you're better than someone else, where you want your status to be clear, you could play something like this in.
Okay.
So I've got some preliminary statuses that tie to numbers. So when something goes up and down, you can really change like it really changes the story. So right now what I've been doing is I've been working on the starting statistics. So when you've got those three cards and you first start like your one or two statistics, like that sort of helps develop who your character is in the beginning, just like in Fiasco where you're rolling those dice and you're seeing what you have to choose from the play sets.
Right.
So for example, if we're looking at clubs, which is your reputation, if you end up starting with a two of clubs, first of all, your first three starting cards always ties you to someone to your left or someone to your right. So just like in Fiasco, you've got those established relationships.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if you started with a two in reputation, then right off the bat, you got caught cheating.
Okay.
And nice. I haven't specified here if you were cheating in the relationship or you were cheating at the game, you know, because everyone's sort of playing this very public status. Like life is this very public status fight. So, you know, that can be twisted in different ways.
Okay.
You know, number four on clubs, which is another low number, is your former cellmates, you and this other person.
Oh.
But if you start out with something nice, if you pull something like a king, for example, then you've got a celebrity fan relationship with somebody. You're going to get to start off sort of famous for something.
Nice.
Yeah. And the same thing is true for the other suites, you know, with body, which is spades. If you start off as with a queen, you were you both survived something traumatic together, and that's sort of like, so you're starting off as sort of almost the diehard type guy, like who's been through a whole ordeal already and he's built himself up.
Okay.
Or if you start with a five on that, which is kind of low, one of you is the bully and the other person is the target of that person's bullying.
Ah.
So right away you've sort of got a baseline to play with to sort of start that story.
Yeah.
And I think eventually that's what I would want. I want little, quick, cheap PDFs because you don't really need to buy a special deck for this. You could theoretically make your own deck and you could write these things on it. You could sell that. But that's not necessarily what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
You know, you get this quick little PDF. You grab a deck that you already have. You can get playing right away. So you've got a place that you start. You've got something to aspire to. And the dealer can help sort of point you in different directions. But for the most part, people are going to have their own motivations right off the bat from these base relationships.
Okay. And so you're just kind of, you're interacting with the other players based on these relationships. You're changing your status as you interact or you're always going to try and improve your own status as the story progresses.
Well, that's the idea. That is the penultimate goal of the game, is for you to improve your own status.
Yeah.
But in a role-playing game, that's not always what somebody seeks out. So while everyone's going to start out trying to improve their status, there's no reason why a relationship might get so complicated that you take the hit for somebody.
Oh,
you know?
Okay. Yeah.
You know, maybe you'll take the two from somebody and give them your king because that's where you are in the relationship, where you really want to propel that person forward. Because in a role-playing game, it's not necessarily about winning.
Yeah.
Of course. Right, right.
Sure.
Right. Well, it's like Fiasco. I mean, I know that sometimes when you're playing Fiasco, you really just want to lose really, really bad.
Yep,
you absolutely just want it to go terrible because that's fun too.
Because it's not about winning. It's about having fun and telling the story and seeing where it goes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then again, if you wanted to spin this like Munchkin, because this is really early into development,
yeah,
you could totally do it, where you're always trying to screw everybody else, and it's less serious and it's more lighthearted, and you're always really trying to get your statuses up.
You know,
what, you could really go either way at this point.
Sure.
And different groups may play differently.
Right. One playset type idea that comes to mind that I actually have heard Liz Bauman talk about online before, as she does with Dread, is a Hunger Games thing. Something like this would really work well for that. Because,
absolutely,
you know, you're working together sometimes, but in the end, you're really trying just all to kill each other.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So, I mean, you might take that sacrifice and give someone the king, knowing that you're going to screw them two turns later.
Yeah,
you know?
But you might get someone the king knowing you have the ace in your hand.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're like, oh, you're right, my friend. And then you're like, shank.
Yeah.
Sorry about your luck.
Because even though you pull a card every turn, you don't necessarily discard each turn. Discarding is probably going to be a lot rarer than in most games. You know, there's no forced discard in this game.
Yeah.
Now, it might be fun if there was, though. I mean, so just an idea here. If one of the penalties of losing these battles was that the person, whatever action is being taken that turn by the whole group, say, the person that's going to choose to take the hit in the end or is going to lose that turn, not lose, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They have to pitch a card, right?
Yep.
So, you know,
but I mean, you're always betting a card no matter what. So if you're going to challenge the dealer in a round, that card you're pulling, you know, your one pull that round is what's up for grabs.
Okay.
And by challenging the dealer, you might get two instead of just grabbing one.
Okay.
But you might not get any. And you start with so few resources. You start with three.
Right.
And unless you're convincing other players to give you cards, you can only pull in one a turn.
Right. I get you. No, that does make sense. Man,
although,
there's so many applications for a game like this, for a system like this.
Now,
I mean, one of my early thoughts was like a Western. I mean, this, because in a Western, so much is of it, it's about how other people view you.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, the question that nobody's asked yet, but it was the first thing that occurred to me, can you leave the Jokers in the deck, and what do you do with those?
Well, I have a note here to myself that says you play with the two Jokers, but I don't have a note to myself that says what you do with those Jokers.
And then, if you want to get really crazy, do you leave the little rules card in the deck, too?
Ooh. I don't know. Then you're crazy.
I think you would be crazy then. I like the idea of the Jokers that this. I'm just going to throw this out here. They have no set value, but when you put them in play in one of your four abilities or your four stats, they are always higher than one person for that stat.
Oh, that's cool.
So, like, I would say at the table, like, this Joker will always be higher, a higher diamond than Rob has in play.
Oh, and if Rob gets an ace, then you're better than an ace and no one can possibly beat you.
Exactly. But Rob could purposely screw himself to screw you back, right? By dropping his ace.
Yeah.
So just a thought.
But if...
Yeah.
I mean, there's only two, so why not make them powerful, right?
But if it...
A Joker could be like a bomb card. Like, so if I've got a Joker in my hand and somebody challenges me, maybe I don't actually want to have the Joker. So now I make public he has to take it.
Yeah.
Because there's only two of them in the whole deck, right?
Right. So,
but if you put a Joker against a Joker...
Oh, I don't know. That sounds like we're putting a bag of holding in a portable hole now.
I think that would have to be some kind of horrible catastrophic failure.
Like both players like reset all their stats.
Yep. It's like shooting the moon, right? Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe... I feel like there can be... For people who really like mechanics, this is even though it sounds complicated as I'm talking about it, I think once you get going, it's very simple. It's sort of just like round robin war.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there should be like we could play with the whole idea that we're playing a game of cards and have, you know, the fact if you get two pairs it means something, or if you get a royal flush it means something.
Yeah.
And I haven't developed that at all.
Yeah, especially like to have a flush where you've got like all, you know, well, no, you can't have a flush, duh.
You can't have a flush. Right.
Especially if you really have a flush, because then you're obviously cheating.
Right. So you can't have a royal flush either.
But you could
have a full house.
You could have a straight.
You could have a straight. You could have two, three, four of a kind.
Yeah. Well, maybe once you have four cards down, then you can play the fifth as like your power card or whatever. You know, it's like Powerball in the lottery. I don't know.
That would actually be really cool though, man. If you had a straight, like if you have basically have an open ended straight, right?
Yeah.
In front of you, which means you can play on either end of that.
Yeah.
If you have a card that matches that, like you get to put that out and it somehow affects the game. Mm-hmm. Because it wouldn't happen all that often, but you know, I mean, you'd see someone going for it. I mean, it'd be kind of like a power play in the game. Man, yeah, there's so many ways to apply this to different ideas. Even more so than Fiasco, I think, actually.
Oh, yeah. This is something that I put on the back burner because I'm primarily a freelancer. So this is an idea I had. I wrote a bunch of it down. I moved on to other projects. And I keep sort of like looking at it, reading it, going, oh, that's a fun idea, and then doing other things.
We know how that happens.
Yeah.
What I want to do is I kind of want to like really stare at the rules of some existing card games, like really like stare at the rules of Rummy.
Okay, well, if I can pause and interrupt the show for a moment to our patient and kind listeners, we just had a little minor technical snafu, which involved my computer completely crashing, going all the way to the blue screen of death, and Jason and I panicking, and you know, very nearly crapping our pants and pulling our hair out, and Brian just patiently waiting like a wonderful human being, and politely humming Sweet Caroline to himself. And Brian, you are now our official favoritist and most appreciated guest because you have put up with so much garbage from us to get this episode recorded. So thank you, sir.
You're very welcome. I'm proud to be the bearer of your. I'll take all the difficulties so the other guests don't have to.
you are generous.
Brian
generous
is like our own personal Job.
Yes, that's right.
Love it.
But anyway, to get back to Ante, I think we were wrapping up anyway, right?
Yeah. I mean, we talked about a lot of different directions it could go in, and I agree. Like, this is a game that has a lot of potential, and I could do a lot of stuff with it.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic idea. I'm really glad that we were able to define it a little better by talking about its relation to the structure of Fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
That helped me a lot to comprehend what you were explaining to me. So to any listeners who might still be a little bit lost and have not played Fiasco, I think that is an excellent way for you to... first of all, Fiasco is a fantastic game.
Fantastic.
And you should go play that. Then think about that concept and that structure with this idea of deck of cards and the randomness of that, or you know, the strategy of holding your hand and building your hand to achieve your goals. And I think it's a fantastic idea. I would love to try it, man.
To me, this sounds like Fiasco, but more fun. I'm not just saying that. I really believe that.
It feels like Fiasco.
I really like Fiasco, so I don't know, man.
But it feels like it has the opportunity for more strategy.
Yeah, I mean, because there isn't strategy in Fiasco.
No.
It's all about sort of just telling the story. And you're right. In this one, there's strategy because it's got that game mechanic underneath it that Fiasco really doesn't have. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that about it. I really do because, you know, I'm somebody who likes a game like Fiasco, but I want a little more structure. And this mm-hmm. really does that. And that's cool.
That's cool. I hope that you go farther with this, sir.
Yeah, you know, it's something that I definitely want to work on at some point, and it's just this will definitely help push me forward.
Okay, so listeners, you heard it here first. Wait and see it. Brian will be debuting Ante at Gen Con this year. You just look him up, and he'll have it playable, ready to go for you, right?
Oh yeah, we'll have something.
No obligation, I guess. Okay, I think we're good.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Good
well,
time.
let's throw out some of your plugs again, Brian. The biggest thing right now again was Pulp, and you have that. Yes.
Go buy Pulp. You'll have to this Friday the number to buy Pulp, and if you buy Pulp during that period, it will all the sales profits will go to the Red Cross.
Excellent.
If you buy it after that, all the profits will go to me, which is also good because I will write more Pulp.
Either way, it's good though.
Yep. If you want to buy older things of mine, you can go to Kobold Press, koboldpress.com. I've done a lot of their fourth edition work. You can check out the Midgard Bestiary, check out old issues of Kobold Quarterly, check out things that are happening in the future. If you want to know what's happening in the future, you can go to beerstargames.com. There's an RSS feed there. You can go to our Google Plus community. You can follow me on Twitter, at Brian LaBurge. I will talk about those things. I'll talk about some of my current things like RPG Circus and the Urban Dressing Line for Pathfinder. I'm always doing something. It's a good old time.
Fantastic. And we will make sure that we provide links to all of those things on our website in the show notes.
Yes, we
will. Good luck.
There are a lot to keep track of.
Prob says that because it's
job.
My job.
Yeah. Okay. And we want to... Do you have anything else, Jason?
No.
Okay, then we want to thank our listeners for hanging in there with us. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being our fans. Thank you for being who you are and loving games. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us at buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at podcastbtg. Jason is at J.A. Slingerland, and I am at poorly_designed. You can also go to our website, which is buildingthegamepodcast.com, and you can leave comments on the show. If you have any comments for us or for Brian, leave them right there on the entry for this show. We promise we will read them and share them with Brian. You can also like us on Facebook. Don't forget that if we can get up to 100 likes, Jason will release an exclusive print and play version of his snowball fight game. So give us those likes, give us those thumbs up, tell your friends. It's exciting. Also, you can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and you can keep on coming back all the time, every time, whenever you want. I mean, that's kind of the whole idea of podcasts. You put it on your pod, on your iPod or your listening device, and you can listen to it anytime you want to. You know, you don't have to tune in necessarily. You know how these things work, right? I mean,
everyone does.
You're listening to it right now.
This is not warning. This is not a live stream. Just to be clear.
Not alive. No.
Fortunately.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Brian, thank you again so much, sir. Really, truly thank you. It has been a pleasure.
It was great for me. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Awesome.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game.
All right, Rob, stop that. Save that right now.
Stop
before anything happens.